Om. I'm happy to be with you for study of Bhagavad Gita. And on the weeks when Yogacharya is not here, I begin by sharing a review of her recent teaching, and then I generally pick one of the verses that she taught about to share some reflections on, and then time for you to share any questions or comments that you have. We pause for a moment of prayer, turning our attention toward study. We offer our pranams, our respect and gratitude to all who have brought forth and are bringing forth the sacred teachings found in the Bhagavad Gita in such a manner that they are useful in our life. May our study be fruitful, and may it awaken our innate wisdom. Om, peace, peace, peace. We're in chapter 5, verses 1 through 5 of the Bhagavad Gita, and this chapter once again opens with Arjuna being confused. And that's important. You know, Arjuna's confusion is not a failure. It's a mirror for us. You know, the same dilemmas arise again and again in our lives, especially when we are under pressure. You know, what should I do? What's the right path? Isn't there an easier way? And Arjuna, in essence, is in a work-life crisis. You know, he's already been told by Krishna, stand up, act. He's been told, you know, to follow his dharma. Yet he wonders if there's a faster, cleaner, more spiritually efficient route. Don't we think that sometimes? Which one is better? Tell me this definitely. And at the heart of it, he's asking an ancient and an ever new question. Is the highest spiritual path renunciation or engagement? Is it better to withdraw from the world or to serve God in the world? And this confusion often arises when life feels difficult, doesn't it? We pray, but answers don't always come immediately. And so the mind starts spinning, trying to find ways to escape or to control. But soul guidance requires something very specific. A quiet, neutral mental field. Neither grasping nor resisting. Because when the mind is busy trying to get what it wants, it's too congested for anything else to be revealed. Arjuna politely confronts Krishna. He says, Divine Teacher, he says, on one hand, you praise Jnana Yoga, the yoga of wisdom and discernment, often associated with monks and renunciants. On one hand, you praise Jnana Yoga. On the other, you tell me to act, to engage in karma yoga, serving God through duty in the world. He says, well, which is it? Which is it, monk or householder? This is a universal human dilemma. You know, we often want one clear answer. Tell me what to do. One superior path that will guarantee realization with the very least friction. And when life feels hard, whatever path we're on, the other one seems so much better. The grass is always greener, right? Especially when we're on the battlefield of life. A little sidebar, I'm looking at you in this room and I'm online, and you, right? We're in these times where our life is changing dramatically. You know, as if there's a moment that it isn't. But we're paying attention now about how our life is changing. And sometimes the monks here are thinking, oh my God, what have I done? I need to get back in the world. I don't think they think that too often. But sometimes, you know, like, can I do more in the world that will make a bigger difference for CSE or for my own awakening? Like that. Not running from monkhood. However, those of us in the world sometimes want to run to monkhood, don't we? Whoa, can I escape this? But, you know, this pull toward renunciation isn't only escapism. Yogacharya Umaji taught that all spiritual archetypes live within us. The warrior, the healer, the parent, the monk, the teacher, all live within us. So in any given lifetime, one or more of these archetypes will be suited to our dharma, our soul's purpose. Umaji shared about her own experience as a young woman discovering the path of Kriya Yoga. She felt a powerful yearning toward self and God realization, and simultaneously felt drawn inward toward a monastic life. And at the same time, resistant to that. Well, do I really have to give up my children? Right? She was married with children, with work responsibilities. So she felt both deeply in the world and not fully prepared for the rigors of formal renunciation. That tension's very human. It's normal. Even saints have expressed it. Saint Augustine famously prayed, grant me chastity and continence, but not yet. Mm-hmm. We want freedom, but we want it on our own timeline. And then Krishna responds clearly in verse 2 of chapter 5. He says, both renunciation and the yoga of action lead to incomparable bliss. But of the two, the yoga of action is superior. Why? Because true renunciation is internal. In verse 3 of chapter 5, Krishna defines the true renunciant as one who neither hates nor desires, one who is free from the poles of opposites, and is therefore easily liberated. So freedom does not come from avoiding action. It comes from acting without attachment to results. and from releasing the sense of I am the doer, and this belongs to me. So the key is motivation. What is my motivation for this action? A true renunciant, whether in a monastery or in the world, is motivated by serving God and living harmony in truth. They're not driven by selfish desires. They're not stopped by fear of loss. They're not grasping. Roy Eugene Davis defines it this way: Karma Yoga is the practice of mental renunciation of results, not the avoidance of necessary action. He just says it all in a sentence, as usual. He goes on in this verse, duties are fulfilled cheerfully and skillfully without craving praise or reacting to blame. Through selfless service, the ego is purified, humility grows, and karma is gradually neutralized. For most of us, this transformation takes time. The path is not a freeway. It's a steady road requiring discipline and perseverance. Or, as it's put in the Zen tradition, the great way is easy, but people prefer the side paths. And then in verses 4 and 5, chapter 5, Krishna dissolves this apparent conflict entirely. He says, Samkhya and Yoga, Samkhya, Jnana Yoga, and Karma Yoga are different, the childish declare. Let me flip that around. The childish declare that Samkhya and Yoga are different. Not the wise. Practiced correctly, one leads to the fruit of both. Wisdom Yoga, Jnana, clarifies our true identity as the Divine Self. And Karma Yoga purifies the mind so that self-knowledge is naturally revealed. They are not two different destinations. They're just one destination approached from different angles. This is where the path of Kriya Yoga shines as an integrated path. Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga purify the heart and the mind. And Jnana Yoga provides ultimate discernment and liberation. It's interesting to study all the different paths of yoga, isn't it? And find ourselves in all of it. And our lineage of Kriya Yoga reflects all these different approaches beautifully. Babaji, the cave dweller avatar. Lahiri Mahashaya, the enlightened householder. Sri Yukteswar, the householder who turned Swami. Paramahansa Yogananda, the monk by destiny. Roy Eugene Davis, the monk who later became an enlightened householder. And of course, we have our own living guru, our own living teacher, Yogacharya O'Brien, who shows us how to live an awakened life as a householder. Different forms, same realization. Zen Master Xu Yun wrote, saints and ordinary folks are the same from the start. Every Dharma is known in the heart. So which is best? Which is best? The one that is appropriate for you. The one that's aligned with your dharma, your responsibilities, your gifts in this moment of your life. Have you noticed that your life changes? There are moments where being a householder is exactly the right thing. And there are moments where, for some, being a monastic is exactly the right thing. One's not better than the other. Krishna tells Arjuna that karma yoga is best because it is best for Arjuna in that moment. Just a little sidebar. Sometimes I have friends and different, like cousins, spiritual cousin friends, at Ananda and different, you know, SRF and places like this. And sometimes they'll say something like, well, you know, Kriyananda taught it this way. You know, but Roy taught it this way. Both of them had the same teacher. But that teacher will tell, may tell this person, hey, go sweep the sidewalk. And tell this person, go study the Yoga Sutras. Because that's what each person needs. That's what their dharma is in the moment. One is not better than the other. The one that is appropriate for you. So the Gita reveals a progression. Early on, we're guided to act dharmically, aligning thought, speech, and action with our higher purpose. And then later, the mind is purified, and self-knowledge is established, and then right action becomes spontaneous. The inner work of constant correction falls away. Action flows naturally through self-realization. So at the very end of the Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, abandon all dharmas. Right? So he has told him, action's best. No, study's best. Drop them all. Why? Because at some point, action falls away and we're guided from the divine within. It's not a contradiction, it's a culmination. And so Yogacharya Umaji closed her lesson on this topic with the steady encouragement of Lahiri Mahashaya. Keep on keeping on. Keep on keeping on. Behold, one day, the goal. So, I chose verse 3 to focus on. Chapter 5, verse 3. There's so much in each verse. And I titled it Renunciation Through Inner Transformation. Chapter 5, verse 3. That person is to be known as a true renunciate who neither hates nor desires, free from the pairs of opposites. Such a one is easily liberated from bondage. Just reading that, I could hear the voice of Umaji's guru, Roy Eugene Davis, saying, you can awaken in this lifetime, free from the pairs of opposites. Such a one is easily liberated from bondage. So in chapter 5, Arjuna asks the question that is in the heart of every one of us, every sincere seeker. Is freedom found from stepping away from life or by living in the world with wisdom. And Krishna responds by dissolving the apparent conflict between renunciation and action. He teaches that true renunciation is not about withdrawing from responsibility. It's about freedom from inner compulsion. So in this one verse, in this single verse, Krishna describes the liberated person. So simple. He says the liberated person is one who neither hates nor desires, neither pushes away or grasps. One who remains steady amid life's opposites. Too much going on, not enough going on. Hot, cold. Abundance, lack. All the opposites. One who remains steady. And then he says, this one becomes free naturally and gracefully. It is such a promise. And this teaching resonates deeply with the path of Kriya Yoga, with our approach to liberation. Tapas, Swadhyaya, Ishwari Pranidhan. Self-discipline, self-study, self-surrender, and then meditation to integrate all of it. So the first dimension of this transformation is tapas, self-discipline. And often it's misunderstood as a sort of hard effort or rigid control. Think about this path of Kriya Yoga and this verse, chapter 5, verse 3. How do we find the freedom that is promised? For us in yoga, tapas means purifying effort. The willingness to remain steady. Remain steady in whatever supports awakening. Isn't that a nice definition of tapas? Mm-hmm. Remain steady. Krishna's statement that the renunciate neither hates nor desires points us directly to this discipline. Remain steady. You know, if we're steady, we pause before reacting. We're not thrown off. We remain aligned with inner truth rather than being impulsive. Remain steady. You know, we talk about in yoga being steady through the spine and in Kriya, but we also talk about that in our life, right? Having an upright life. Remain steady. Sustain a daily practice. Be steady. Even when motivations fluctuate, I don't really feel like it. Oh, yesterday was so busy, I think I'll just stay home. My toe hurts. Whatever. I mean, I think about people in very difficult circumstances in their life. You can think about Gandhi, you know, being imprisoned and how steady he was. How steady he was. You know, people who are in very difficult situations in this nation and in other nations. It's so inspiring, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You meet someone who's gone through so much, and they've kept their spiritual uprightness through it all. Paramahansa Yogananda wrote, Spiritual success depends on steady effort and self-control. The uncontrolled mind is the greatest obstacle to freedom. So, you know, in today's world where distraction is constant and immediacy is rewarded, you know, you go to Amazon and you're like shocked that it's not going to come the next day. Right? That's craziness. Self-discipline becomes a sacred act of renunciation in a time where there's so much agitation and immediacy. Each time we choose steadiness over reactivity, we're weakening the forces of karmic bondage. You know, that last line of this verse, you will be freed from bondage. Each time we say, oh no, I'm not gonna get pulled over there, I'm gonna be steady, we're loosening those ties. We're weakening the forces of karmic bondage. And then the second pillar of Kriya Yoga, Swadhyaya, self-study. And you all know it's more than, it includes studying sacred texts, but it's much more than that. It is the practice of observing our patterns of attraction and aversion. And the stories that we tell ourselves of why we have this attraction and why we're averse to that. It's observing the emotional habits that shape our perception. Swadhyaya is an intense practice. It's so fruitful, isn't it? You know, if we can have enough clarity, stay steady in us, have enough tapas, to just watch. Wow, look at that emotional reaction my ego is having. What a drama. And watch it, but don't be in it. Watch it. Free movie. So Krishna invites Arjuna and us to recognize that bondage is not created by outer circumstances. It arises from an unconscious identification with the mental fluctuations. In his book, Living the Eternal Way, Roy Eugene Davis, you want me to say that part again? Yeah. Bondage is not created by something outside of us. You know that. It arises from unconsciously identifying with the mental fluctuations. And the first four sutras in verses of Yoga Sutra addresses this. In his book, Living the Eternal Way, Roy Eugene Davis writes, spiritual growth requires honest self-observation and the willingness to release limiting tendencies. So through self-study, we begin to see where desire is masking security. If I have this, I will be okay. If this is here, I will be okay. If they do that, I will be okay. And we can begin to see where resistance is masking fear. If that doesn't happen, I'll be okay. What are we grabbing onto? What are we pushing away? And we can witness, we can observe where our identity is being built around temporary conditions. Are you really a monk? Or is that a temporary condition? Am I really a teacher, or is that a temporary condition? Who am I really? Am I really a mother? A daughter? You know, what am I really? And then the third dimension, well, I want to just say self-study in our culture, I think, is radical. It's a radical return to inner clarity. Not getting pushed and pulled all over the place. So, and then the third dimension, Ishwaripranidhan, perhaps the most transformative, is self-surrender. And you know, self-surrender does not mean passivity. It means releasing the illusion that we are the ultimate controller of our life. I mean, think about that. Can you do that? You have to be steady, right? You need tapas to do this. You can do it. You have to be steady. You have to study what's going on. Observe. Then begin to release this idea that you are in control of anything. How freeing is that? Krishna's description of renunciation as one who's free from the pairs of opposites reflects that consciousness that rests in something deeper than personal preference. Swami Sri Yukteswar taught, is reflected in the Holy Science, when the ego yields to the divine reality within, suffering dissolves. I mean, that would be good if it just stopped there. It goes on a little bit. Think about that. When the ego dissolves, when the ego yields, lets go to the divine reality, to the essence of being, suffering dissolves. Because the soul remembers its unity with spirit. Self-surrender softens the heart, and it transforms struggle into trust. I decided, I told some of you, and maybe I told everyone, I think I might have offered a message on this topic. I was telling my hairdresser about this, and she goes, well, you should tell the whole community. And then I remembered I had a Sunday talk that was on this whole topic, that this year I decided would be the year that I accept the world as a friend. And that I engage in the world with curiosity, without having to be right. I know. I can see one of my old, meaning not age, but old spiritual mentors, I can see her thinking, I told you that 25 years ago. Well, I'm getting it. Hang in there with me. Think about that. Engage curiosity. Wow. Why is it that people cut in front of me in line? Why is it I got cut off on the freeway? Why is it that cars, wow, instead of, I own this highway, why aren't you going the speed I think you should go? And then watch. Be curious. It's so fun. Be curious. And, you know, I'm practicing swadhyaya. And so I notice when, you know, I don't want to be curious. I want to be right. You know, I should be the one doing this thing. Why is someone else doing that? Don't you know who I am? You know, and then if you just put a mirror there, don't you know who I am? Because when we know who we are, we don't have to be right. Because it's all right. It's all right. So, curiosity, what a fun game. Self-surrender, when we soften the heart, it allows us to live responsibly while recognizing a deeper intelligence that's guiding existence. I mean, just think about it. You don't have to be in control. You're in a boat. You've been rowing. You've had all the kids, all the students, all the whoever, co-workers, all the other nations. You've been rowing in the boat. Wow, you get to just let the oars rest and the river is carrying you. Think about it. Self-surrender, you know, in times of uncertainty, social, political, environmental unrest, self-surrender provides profound stability. You look what's going on in parts of our nation and in parts of the world, and you wonder, what can I do? Right? And some people feel despair. Like, there's nothing I can do. My heart's breaking. These things are happening. One of the things we can do is practice deeply so that, you know, there's only one consciousness. So the deeper we go, you all know this, it's like a ripple. Mm-hmm. Right? People near you want what you have. Oh, your light's on. How do I get that? You say, well, come to this retreat with me. Or start meditating with me. Or on your own. Self-surrender anchors us in the knowing, in the awareness that divine order operates even in the midst of chaos. For this kind of thing, you know the story, it's too soon to tell. There's a story, it's too soon to tell. So while self-discipline, self-study, self-surrender reshape our relationship to life, meditation integrates it. And then it stabilizes the transformation that is occurring. Superconscious meditation calms our nervous system and helps us to draw awareness inward. So it's essential in order to practice these other things. Roy wrote in his book, The Path of Light, when awareness is interiorized through meditation, freedom from mental agitation naturally unfolds. It's kind of almost the exact same thing as Gita chapter 5, verse 3. When awareness is interiorized through meditation, freedom from mental agitation naturally unfolds. So meditation reveals this state that Krishna described, the state of being beyond compulsive attraction or aversion, attachment. This verse in the Gita offers us a path. You know, modern life intensifies the pairs of opposites, doesn't it? Success or failure. Good looking, not good looking. Belonging or exclusion. Certainty or fear. Stimulation or exhaustion. And the Gita offers us a path that it does not require escaping these tensions. It's not running away from it, but it invites us to transform our relationship to them. not trying to control what's going on in the world. That's exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
So through self-discipline, tapas, we stabilize behavior. It's steady. Through self-study, we clarify perception. Through self-surrender, we soften the ego-centered identity. And through meditation, we realize inner freedom. We have glimpses of it, don't we? So together, these are a form of expression of renunciation. This is a renunciate. This is the life of a renunciant. It doesn't matter if you have all white on. It doesn't matter if you live in an ashram or in Seattle or San Jose or anywhere in between. Krishna concludes this verse. I love this part. Chapter 5, verse 3, with this remarkable reassurance. Liberation becomes easy when inner conflict dissolves. Doesn't that just make you want to roll up your sleeves? What do I need to do to dissolve inner conflict? Freedom is not achieved, you know, through some dramatic effort or external change. It unfolds as a natural result of purified awareness. Renunciation is not withdrawing from life. Renunciation is transforming how we live our life. When we practice self-discipline with compassion, or self-study with honesty, self-surrender with devotion, meditation with steadiness, when we do this, we gradually discover a freedom that does not depend on anyone or anything outside of us. We remain fully engaged in the world, yet inwardly anchored in peace. This is the renunciation that Krishna is teaching in this verse. And this, I think, is a path that's extremely relevant for us in this time. Om. I really like taking the verses and looking at them through the lens of Kriya Yoga.
Mm.
You know, what is this telling me about why we practice the things we practice?
Mm.
Because, you know, when you're on the path for years, sometimes things can get kind of lax, right? Well, I know I'm supposed to do that, but I'll just do it a little. So we have a few minutes for questions, comments, no confessions, not needed. Wondering, isn't it wonderful to look at each path and how it's unfolding in our life? You know, where does the bhakti show up for me? Where am I walking this path as a karma yogi? Where does jnana show up for me? Hi, Saraswati. Mukti Devi, can they unmute themselves?
Okay, I'm muted. Good morning. I just want to just briefly say how much I appreciate how you've connected this one verse to all three pillars of Kriya Yoga. That's amazing, and I love that. So thank you.
You're welcome. I kind of thought I might try to do that each time, but I'm not holding myself to it because God
mm-hmm.
may have a different plan.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't be attached, but I'll be willing, because I think it's important for us to keep right in front of us why we're doing the things we're doing. Yeah, thank you
Yeah,
so
it's
much.
really, really helpful. Thank you.
Nice to see you. Yes, Sister Prabhama.
I like what you said about, you know, if I'm grasping, I'm trying to control. And what am I trying to do? Like, I'm trying to be safe or everything's going to be okay. Or if I'm resisting, it's fear and looking like, what am I fearful of? Yeah, thank you for that.
You're welcome. Could you hear her? Yes. It's a nice thing to have these pointed out. So when we're practicing Swadhyaya, when we're observing ourselves and we're being curious, we become curious. Why am I grasping after that last piece of chocolate? Trying to grab it before Sister Prabhama grabs it. Or why am I staying away from that chocolate that's been offered to me as prasad? I'm sorry to use food as a thing. It's just, I had a memory of our Ganesh installation ceremony yesterday. Lilia!
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your beautiful teachings. In trying to deal with the mind in meditation, I have heard several times some of you saying in preparation, saying to invite the mind to drop into the heart. So how do you do that?
That's a great question. This morning, were you here for meditation this morning? Yes?
Yes.
Ah, okay, thank you.
The problem sometimes is that,
yes,
I have to say this, because several times the leader starts with a,
let the mind drop into
hear,
the heart.
I can hear, but then as you enter into your own meditation, your voice drops, and it's very difficult, not yours, but several of your leaders. And also when you come out of meditation, the same thing, you come out of that beautiful space, but it's very difficult to hear completely. So that's one of the things
you.
I wanted to to observe.
Thank you so much, Lilia, for that feedback.
Yeah.
I will share it with others as a reminder that we're speaking to you wherever
yeah,
you're
because
living. And letting your mind drop into your heart means to let go of thinking. It means to let go of thinking, and oh, it doesn't mean the emotional heart. I know you know that. But it means to let your awareness drop into something bigger than just your thinking brain. And so for me, you know, if my mind is chattering, I sit down to meditate. If my mind is chattering, what I do is I imagine that there's an energy in my mind, which there is, and I pretend or feel like it's dropping down into the back of my heart, between my shoulder blades. Because for me, when I think of the front of my heart, I think of emotions. And we don't want to bring up emotions. This is just how I do it. And so when I bring my awareness to the back of my heart area, between the shoulder blades, what happens for me is I get this expansive feeling that's open. Everything just falls away. So this morning I said, you know, lay it down at the feet of the Lord. That was another way of saying, let your mind drop into your heart. My mentor, Emily Sanford, may have said, let go and let God. So that's what it means. Let it go. Thank you for the beautiful question and for the feedback. I will communicate that to our other leaders as well.
Thank you.
I think Mukti has her hand up.
Mm-hmm.
Om Mukti Devi.
Thank you. As always, thank you. Your words clarify so much for me that I wasn't ready to see at the first time through, I think, and it's really helpful. I was also just very struck by, because you were talking about being released from compulsions, I started to correlate what you were saying with any program that deals with people who are working on letting go of addiction and
Yeah, like 12-step
compulsion.
programs.
Exactly, 12-step programs. And I really loved wording in the middle. You said that when we were doing svadhyaya, self-study, we wanted to observe where attractions are masking security and where resistance is masking fear. And that was such a helpful way for looking at well, fears, resentments, and then we're asked in a 12-step way with the fourth step is self-study too, which to understand where these fears and resistances are affecting us. And very often they are affecting us in those ways. We're looking at, the fears we have, where it affects emotional security, financial security, all of those things. And it's not always clear why we're looking at how it affects us in our life. And this really provides a very strong and clear pathway for me for integrating those things together and seeing the usefulness of that exercise.
Oh,
So,
beautiful. And
thank you.
we're blessed in Kriya Yoga, of course, with meditation, of course, and the three pillars and the steadiness of tapas is essential for svadhyaya, for self-study, for asking those questions. And self-surrender is essential for those the fruits of those questions to bring freedom. So, hi, Vivica.
Good morning. Thank you for again for the beautiful teachings, as has been spoken many times. I just want, first of all, to begin by expressing how I appreciate the sincerity and the transparency of your own practice as you've shared it with us this morning. It's really beautiful. It opens my heart very deeply. And a couple of things that I really related to. One of the things that I'm really focused on right now is understanding how the thinking mind does this attachment and aversion. I've been looking at it very, very deeply. I have a sort of my seed that I've been nourishing from 2025 into this year. And it goes like this. I am cultivating a trusting mind that knows and embodies its intimacy with life as a wave knows and embodies its intimacy with the ocean. And there's without thought, that it just is happening, right? And one of the ways that I practice this, and it makes me think of, seeing the world as a friend, is literally looking at a person and saying, regardless, I know you. You are familiar to me. You are the same self. Because there's, and what I'm practicing here at home, I find is it's a hot pot at home. There's a lot going on in the world, and there's a lot of what I'm going to call othering happening in the world. And so I'm looking at how can I contribute in my own way to lessen the impact of that. And this practice of seeing the world as a friend really begins to lessen that. And I look, around my home and the places where I'm creating space between myself and Natasha, and I'm like, it, and just to stop the mind from doing that process while I'm at home, to lessen this impact of othering, even with the person that I love, the
That's
most.
such a beautiful reflection, Vivica. Thank you. And you can feel the power of that, which seems like a simple step from the outside, but from the inside, it is, what do you call it? De-othering?
The
Also known as embracing, I think. Thank you so much for sharing that. What a powerful, powerful invitation, right? We want there to be more, I don't know if union's the right.
Oneness.
A realization of more oneness and less, you know, us and them in the world. So the world is my friend. The wave is the ocean, right? How beautiful. Please write a poem about that. You're such a good writer. Right?
They should.
Someone said, yes, they should. But don't be attached to it or averse of it. Just let it sit. Let your mind drop into your heart and hold it. Okay, any other sharings before we move on? Sakshi, are you raising your hand? Or are you just saying hi? You're muted, so we don't know.
All right, now I got it. Your word steadfastness really has held my attention. I see myself as steady, and yet recently in my life with, you know, different circumstances and changing of events, to allow to rest while being steady. That's a, I'm just sitting with it and seeing how to do that.
That's a beautiful way to see it. You know, I envision, I mean, I'm an athlete, so I often bring the body into it. So I envision the spine like a hollow tube, right? And when we envision it that way, the energy is moving, but it's resting at the same time.
Right.
What a beautiful way to hold that steadiness and resting. So resting in steadiness. I love that.
Wow.
Yeah, beautiful.
Thank you. It to translate that into a daily in my daily routine is the creativity.
Yes, creativity and curiosity are very similar, aren't they? Because they require an openness for things to present themselves. So, yeah, when we're steady, the only way we can experience freedom and rest in that is to not push or pull. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, we have Marley. Hi, Marley.
Hi. My question may not make sense.
Uh-oh.
It is kind of wouldn't attachment to self-realization prevent it from happening?
Did you say, does attachment to self-realization prevent it from happening?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, but isn't Kriyoga the desire to self-realization?
Well, it's the wrong context, because what it says when we have attachment is that we need to gain something, that it's outside and we need to hold it. So it's the wrong context, because we can't cause self-realization. Does that make sense? You keep, in order to be attached to something, we see it as separate.
Okay.
And self-realization is not separate. It already is. So you can have a desire that's different than an attachment. You can have desire without attachment, and that's what you want for liberation, right? You want to have a heartfelt desire for liberation, but not attachment, because attachment closes things down. You know, that saying, whatever you resist persists. Attachment is an energy of constriction, but liberation is an open energy. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. So attachment is to the outside.
Yes.
Okay.
So you can have desire without attachment. There's healthy desire. That's a great question. You're not the only one with it. So thank you for voicing that question. It's a very deep question to contemplate. So now the curiosity, the, you know, question is, what's the difference between attachment and desire for me toward liberation? So I would ponder that. It's a great question. Okay, Sachin and Sarika. Om.
Thanks so much for the teachings today. I had a question. I did ask that Umaji in the last Gita studies, and then she answered that. And I was contemplating more, and then about anything that brings that attachment or even the difficulty in any way. She mentioned to me, like, if you're not able to meditate, I can go for focusing on breathing, right? And then I contemplated over it, and I realized, I felt like it has to do with the all the eight limbs, which is yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahar, dharana, dhyan, samadhi. So everything that I face, it drops me somewhere between these four to be used as a tool. Is that a fair understanding?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
That is beautiful. And Reverend Ann Saraswati is going to be leading a Live the Eternal Way group study that focuses on the yama and niyama. And I actually, when I started putting this lesson together, it must have been for you initially, the first round of what I wrote this was on chapter 5, verse 3, as it relates to practicing the yamas. Because it is that simple. And then I thought, I'll do it on Kriya Yoga instead. So I'll send that to Saraswati so she'll have it for her class. Thank you all for your divine presence. And will you three come up here so they can at least see three of you? A few people had to already leave. But I think you have to go on this side so they can see you. There she is. Where are we? Come in, come in.
Scooch, scooch.
There we go.
Oh, yeah, here you are.
Om. Thank you all. It's wonderful to see you. There's another page of them, but this
when
is
I
the
switch
ones
it over?
Nah, it's okay. May these teachings continue to be revealed in our life. May we feel that we are simply the wave in the ocean and embrace all of life with curiosity and creativity. Om.